everyone. This is March Twisdale, producer and host of Prose, Poetry, and Purpose, and I'd like to welcome you to my interview with Vashon Islander Laurel Seville. Hello, and thanks for joining me today.
Good afternoon, March. Thanks for having me.
Now, Laurel, I don't normally talk about the weather, but it's late February, the sun is shining, and when you live in the Pacific Northwest, I think this is worth mentioning.
It certainly is a beautiful day, and we've had such a wet winter. It's quite welcome to have a brilliant sunshine out there.
I'm like, yay! Okie doke. So, goodness gracious, you got me these books, Henry and Rachel and North of Here, a number of months ago, but I have been very much looking forward to this interview. I'd like to ask if you could just start off by giving our listeners a sense of who you are and you know, a little bit of background, a little bit of context.
Sure. My name is Laurel Seville. I've lived on Vashon for about 3 years. I've been a full-time freelance writer for about 15, 16, 17 years. I'm the author of most recently a memoir and two novels, but I've also written 4, 5, 6 books on various design topics, publication design, graphic design, things like that. I've also written lots of articles, essays, and I do quite a bit of corporate communications consulting work for companies around the world.
You definitely take your writing career, well, completely seriously compared to some people who maybe it's a side activity. I mean, this is what you do.
I sort of think of myself like a farmer. I get up and instead of going to the fields every day, I go to my desk every day and I write. And it's funny because people will say, do you write every day? And I'm always say, I write to eat. So yes.
Yeah. Yeah. I remember that when we were emailing back and forth or something, you had made that comment. I thought it was brilliant. All right. So everyone, I'm really excited because we have 3 ranges we're going to be covering here. There's a spectacular piece. We got together earlier at Cafe Luna and chatted in advance. And so there's a whole piece we're going to cover that will really appeal to our writers and authors out there, especially if you have questions about the publishing side of being an author. Then there are 2 areas of books. There's the nonfiction, which I want to hear more about. And then there's a memoir and 2 novels. So for people who are readers or part of book clubs or whatever, there's some really great things we're going to talk about on that end as well. So how about we go ahead and actually dive right into the publishing piece a little bit. Essentially, you opened a whole window in a way for me on another perspective of looking at publishing, and you gave me an alternative view to what Amazon does for an author compared to a lot of what I've read or heard about in the past. So how about you maybe dive in and explain what your experience has been with Amazon?
Sure. It's very confusing. So it's understandable that there's you're, you know, kind of wondering what's going on because there's been a lot of big headlines in the publishing world.
Mm-hmm.
The publishing world is changing dramatically. And it's an industry that is very oddly fractured and very secretive traditionally. They don't give out much information about sales, and even the authors themselves didn't have information about their product. In some ways, it was akin to the music industry. And like that industry, it's been through a lot of change and become much more democratized,
right,
and a lot more power is going back into the hands of the creators.
Right.
So it used to be that in traditional publishers really controlled all the content and all the information and all the sales data. And once you wrote your book, it went to, and you got a traditional publishing contract, there were all these different gatekeepers. You couldn't even get into a publisher without an agent, and they took a piece of things. And there was sort of an idea that the author should just stay in their little garret apartment and write and not worry their pretty little heads about all the numbers and information and sales and things of that sort, and just take your advance and go on your happy way.
And I think you were mentioning also that a lot of times you gave your copyright, you know, your ownership of your work to a publishing company in the contract, which meant that literally if they decided not to publish your book, sometimes it would just not get published and you would have no control
over it. It's not sometimes. That's the way it works. When you get a publishing contract, they own your work. So you can spend 3 years writing a book and then you get a contract and they own it and they can say, no, we're not going to publish it. And you can't do anything about it. You can't say, okay, well, give me back the book. They might say, yes, maybe no, but basically you might have to put up a lot of your own money to buy back your contract or buy back your copyright. It's just the way it goes, and a lot of people don't realize that. So once they have it, they own it, and they can do whatever they want with the cover. They can do whatever they want with the content. It's really out of your hands.
Mm-hmm.
Amazon does things quite differently, and there's been a lot of change recently. So Amazon used to be just a distributor of books. The publishers would create the books,
right,
and then Amazon would sell them in the same way that a store would. It's just a different kind of a storefront.
Right.
And then Amazon got into publishing themselves, and they created an imprint. And what an imprint is just basically a publishing business.
Mm-hmm.
And they created an imprint called Encore, and what they were looking for was books that had been self-published that their editorial staff thought could do well, and if they had better support in a traditional publishing way. So they would look for those books.
So Amazon offered a platform for people who wanted to self-publish and then recognized that some of these people who were self-publishing maybe were or were not doing a really great job, perhaps, of spreading the word about their work. And so Amazon would be like, if we give them more support, this book could actually do better. And they were going through and picking people up that way.
Sort of.
Go ahead.
So self-publishing is a very different thing. And there were several different businesses that were in the self-publishing platform.
Mm-hmm.
CreateSpace is one of them that started on its own and is now owned by Amazon, but there were a bunch of other ones. They've all consolidated. They recently just got bought by a big publishing house. But there was a variety of ways that you could self-publish. And what Amazon imprint was looking for was books that may have been self-published, may have been published traditionally, but their editor may have just seen it and said, you know, I think we could give this book a lot more support and it would mm-hmm. do better.
Got it.
That was their first imprint. And I had gone through a very traditional route. I got my master's in fine arts from Bennington's Writing Seminars, which is a really good program. And I had a really well-known agent, a small boutique agent, but a very well-known agent.
Mm-hmm.
And we shopped the book around. This was my memoir called Unraveling Anne. Mm-hmm. We shopped it around, a classic story, got lots and lots of praise, but timing was kind of off. That book was being shopped around right at the time period when a bunch of big memoirs came out as being fraudulent.
Really?
So
wait,
the memoir
you,
thing.
Like Three Cups of Tea?
No, way before that. So James Frey, the biggest one, he went on Oprah and got all this publicity for his memoir, and then it came out as completely fraudulent.
Oh.
There was three or four big ones that had massive sales. Augustine Burroughs had a big problem with his.
Mm-hmm.
So they were kind of gun shy. You know, I mean, it's like anything. Things run in fashion mm-hmm. and things like that.
Yeah.
So
yeah,
it was one of those really frustrating things where I'd get these letters back from editors saying great things about the book, but they weren't going to pick it up. And you sort of throw up your hands and say, at least give me something to do.
Mm-hmm.
And the way the traditional publishing world works is they really are very controlling. I had one editor hang on to a manuscript for an entire year, and I was not allowed to do anything else with the book except just let it sit with her while she decided if she wanted to publish it or not.
Oh,
so it's incredibly frustrating. And that's very typical in the traditional publishing world. So after a certain amount of time, I said to my agent, are you done? And she said, yes, I've done everything I can. And I said, I'm going to self-publish. And at that time, self-publishing was kind of on that cusp where it was sort of thought of as vanity publishing and you should never do it and it's going to wreck your career, which is extremely absurd because all kinds of big authors like Edgar Allan Poe and, you know, I mean, just the list goes on and on and on of really, really, you know, historically significant authors that have self-published and didn't get recognition. Even Virginia Woolf, I mean, she published through her husband's publishing house. So anyway,
got
this weird name for a while. So anyway, I self-published and most self-published books sell less than 100 copies, but I was able to sell about 600. Mm-hmm. And then the big industry rag called Publishers Weekly was coming out with a special edition that was going to focus on just self-published books. And if you paid $100, you could get your book listed and they might review it. I got my book in that publication. They did a little review. And about a month later, I got an email from this person. And he said, we're starting this new imprint. And I just really loved your book. And it was one of those emails that you sort of don't really believe. It was so wonderful.
And there are stories out there about being careful, you know.
Yeah.
And
so I got the email and I was living on the East Coast at that time. And I looked at the clock and I said, well, it's 3 hours earlier in Seattle, and called him right up and we had a great conversation. And so that was my start. Since then, Amazon, yes, does self-publishing and they have a platform that you can go on and sort of a Chinese menu, self-publish your own book and choose whether you want to have them design a cover for you or bring your own cover. There's a whole bunch of different things you can do.
Right.
But they also have all these imprints. Mm-hmm. And so they have an imprint that publishes romance. They have an imprint that publishes thrillers. They have an imprint that publishes translations.
Jump in real quick on that, I want to make sure that my listeners and I are understanding. What I find fascinating here is that a big publishing house also will have multiple imprints.
Right.
And, you know, if you go online and you look up Penguin or something,
right,
you know, and you're like, oh, I want it. Next thing you know is like, poof, this web page will pop up with all these different imprints, and you're like, wait, where do I go now? So that's a similarity between Amazon and the big publishing houses. But the difference, as you were mentioning earlier, is the big publishing houses don't have a storefront.
Right. So the big publishing houses, the big publishing houses basically produce the material, but then they have to find somebody else to sell it. Mm-hmm. So think about, for example, the difference between Levi's jeans and Gap jeans. If you want to find Gap jeans, you go to the Gap store to get Gap jeans.
Right.
If you want to get Levi's, you have to say, where are Levi's sold? Well, they might be at the Macy's, they might be at Sears, they might
be... Right, there's not a Levi's store.
There's not a Levi's store, mm-hmm. necessarily. So the big publishing houses are more like Levi's. And you know when you go into a department store that sometimes the clothes aren't displayed exactly the way you want, and you don't have a lot of control. You sort of mm-hmm. say, here's my product, please display it well and sell it well. But you're also, the Levi's are next to Joe's jeans and Sally's jeans and Sam's mm-hmm. jeans, mm-hmm. whereas Gap only has Gap clothes.
They're very different animals because on one hand, the benefit of you can find Levi's in lots of places. They're probably going to pop up at a Macy's or maybe right. pop up at a Costco once in a while. But if you specifically want Levi's, you can't actually be guaranteed they're going to be there.
Right.
Whereas if you go to a Gap store, you're guaranteed the Gap stuff will be there.
And so it's what they call vertical integration, basically. Oh. So publishers, that's part of why they're so terrified when Amazon got into publishing and was offering basically the same services they were to authors.
Right.
Because Amazon, as a publisher, can also offer all these other services because mm. they have a storefront and they have a marketing platform.
So they can streamline things a little bit more.
They can streamline and they can just do a lot more for their authors. Mm-hmm. So I know a lot of authors that were traditionally published and are now published by Amazon and are just so happy because there's so much that Amazon does for their authors, including, because it's a data-driven company, giving us lots and lots of information.
Right. And that's what got us. So what got us onto the conversation was this book, which is your most recent, called North of Here. And this is by Laurel Saville. If you want to look it up online, the last name is spelled S-A-V-I-L-L-E. But put in North of Here and it plugs up pretty quick. So this, I have an advanced reader's copy. It's currently doing this interesting thing at Amazon where if you have an Amazon Prime account, every month, there's a short list of books that are made available to you, and you can pick one for free to download to your Kindle. It's called Kindle First.
Exactly.
Okay, and so currently North of Here in the month of February is one of the books that Amazon chose to be a Kindle First book, right?
Yes, so there's the retail side of Amazon, and then there's the publishing side, and the Kindle First is done through the retail side. So any publisher can try and get their book on Kindle First.
Right.
It's very competitive. And so editors try to submit and say, you know, could you have my book on Kindle First?
So how did you get your book on Kindle First?
My editor at Amazon uh-huh. submitted it and said, you know, feature this title right. as one of many. She was so excited when it happened uh-huh. that she called me and told me that she'd just spent half an hour crying in the ladies' room because she was so excited. Because it's very competitive because
wow.
it's a huge, if you think about what I think the statistic is now 1 in 5 people are Prime members.
Uh-huh.
So
yeah,
it's
exactly.
huge publicity mm-hmm. To get this email that goes out.
I think
and
this
says,
would be in the number of at least millions, if
yeah.
not tens of millions.
Yeah. So it's a very... And so basically for the book is technically coming out on March 1st,
mm-hmm.
but for the month of February, Prime members...
Like free.
Prime members can download it for free and other people can buy it as an ebook for reduced price.
Me as a non-Prime member,
right.
I could go, right.
And what that does for the book is it basically starts to create some buzz. And
right.
So technically the book isn't even out yet, but I have 150 reviews of it
right.
on Amazon. And, you know, like anything, what works, I mean, I do marketing and brand consulting, so a lot of this stuff is very familiar to me,
mm-hmm.
and I understand the strategic aspect as well as a tactical aspect. What it does is create buzz and enthusiasm and energy.
Yeah.
I mean, what they always tell me, my team at Amazon always says, is it almost doesn't matter whether your reviews are good, bad, or indifferent. It's the number of them because
mm-hmm.
it's momentum.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So,
yeah.
you know, nobody's going to like everything. I mean, it always cracks me up when I read reviews of books because the qualities of that work that people love are also the exact same qualities people hate.
Yeah. Yeah, of course.
You know,
right.
it's always, oh, I love this very unusual structure of the book. It was so interesting. Oh, I couldn't stand that very unusual
right.
structure. I couldn't follow it. It's
right.
the same thing over and over again.
Which is why authors, all right, all of you out there who are in that position of trying to make readers happy, we must remind ourselves at all times we are not writing to every human on the planet. We are writing to a large demographic that will like our work, but it doesn't have to be everybody.
You know what they say, the color of consensus. Actually, I think it was Professor Porsche said the color of consensus is mud.
Oh, right. Yeah,
so
that's brilliant.
I don't think you can write, if you try to write for everybody, you just end up pleasing nobody.
Yeah, and driving yourself crazy. Yeah. In the same. Yeah. So when I asked about how it was going, and you had mentioned that you don't want to talk about numbers, it's, you know, and then you got into sort of the history. So the interesting piece for those of you who are still learning about the differences between traditional publishing and other sorts of publishing is that when you are working with Amazon, I think you were saying on a daily basis, you're actually getting concrete numbers.
Yes, I get reports every day of what my numbers are and what the sales have been on Amazon.
Totally different experience for an author.
Yes, and I get royalty checks every month. And traditional publishing can't do that also because there's often agents involved and they're not quite sure how many they've sold. And they've just traditionally held all that information incredibly close. They do not like to share it. I was telling you a story that I was in a social setting with a bunch of Amazon people and they were talking about their various job positions and levels and who, and they were joking about who is more important. And then completely spontaneously, they all turned to me and said, actually, you're the most important person here because you're a customer.
Mm-hmm.
And they do look at their writers as customers and they treat us that way. I mean, the stuff they do for us, it's everything from these really interesting promotional things they can do. But then they also do really nice things like they send you gifts on publishing day or you know, they just really, you really feel cared for. There's an entire team of people there called the author relations team, and their jobs are to be the point of contact for authors to answer questions, to make sure they're happy, to help them get what they need, to support their efforts. You know, and I've talked to a lot of people who came to work for Amazon Publishing from traditional New York City publishing, and they just are amazed at what a different environment it is because...
Right.
You know, for better or for worse, traditional publishing didn't treat their authors that way.
Well, and unless you were, it sounds like the treatment that a small new author through Amazon might experience in the beginning is going to be similar to what a pet author at a big publishing company would have come to expect. Like, you know, once you're the breadwinner for the publishing company, I imagine you probably also get flowers on your birthday or, you know, I imagine they are going to treat you really nice. But it almost, I think a lot of people when they're trying to get into traditional publishing have a feeling that you're begging at the door and trying to get in.
Well, you kind of are.
That's an emotional thing I've picked up. I'm not saying it's factual, but that's
well, it actually is factual for better or for worse. And the numbers are just, again, because they've been held so closely, people have a lot of misunderstanding about the numbers in publishing.
Mm-hmm.
And there is, for better or for worse, there are a limited number of seats at the table.
Right.
And so if somebody has a seat and you know, you sort of feel like you have to displace somebody. But the other thing that people don't understand is how small the numbers really are. Oprah's book club has done many great things, but I think it has also made a lot of people feel like that writing a book is a quick path to riches, which it really isn't. I mean, I, you know, have incredibly wonderful professors from my MFA program who are Pulitzer Prize finalists and National Book Award winners, and they can't afford to live off their book sales. They teach for a reason.
Yeah.
And most people in MFA programs are there for the teaching credential. You know, there was an interesting article recently on NPR that talked about these numbers, and the vast majority of books never sell more than 1,000 copies. The vast majority.
Right.
And a good book sale for a first book would be considering 5,000 copies. Now, when you think about, it's not just 5,000 copies, but it's what a small piece you get of that.
Right.
Because, your royalty, even if, first of all, you're going to get an advance, and most books never, ever earn out their advance, even if the advance is only $5,000 or
$10,000. So let's just repeat that. So you get an advance, $10,000, $5,000, $20,000, whatever. We hear about all these stories of, you know, 15 years ago when people were getting $750,000, you know, advances and crazy stuff
going
on.
But not people, like one or two people.
I know, exactly.
You know?
Exactly. It's an extremely rare situation. But even so, it's like... It is true. There are a lot of people who feel like I'm going to strike it rich and I'll be the next this, that, or the other person. And I think you probably have a better chance of striking it rich as an author, but it can't be much more than winning the lottery as far as the numbers are concerned.
I can't imagine. And the other thing that's, so, you know, if you sell 5,000 copies, so the way it works generally is you get a very small advance unless you're a big name author that's already sold out. And then you would get paid royalties in each book. So let's say you got a $5,000 advance on a first book, mm-hmm. and you sold 5,000 copies, mm-hmm. and your royalty rate is 15%, and you have an agent who's taking 15% of that 15%, mm-hmm. it's very small numbers.
And it's selling for $7. So 15% doesn't even, I don't even think that would hit a dollar yet. Yeah,
it's
so, yeah.
very, very small. I right. mean, Amazon's royalty rates are a little better, but still, you know, you're not getting rich quickly. And mm-hmm. I don't think there's anything wrong with that. I think mm-hmm. people get very discouraged. I was talking at a writer's conference, and this guy was all bummed out that he had sold only 1,000 copies of his self-published children's book. And I said, dude, you should be like skipping. You should be so happy. I mean, that's amazing. That's so rare. The reason I think it's not that bad of a thing is because, you know, really writing is a creative event, and like a lot of creative activities, you do it for the love of the creativity.
Right.
And if you're doing it for the money, I think it kind of pollutes the process, and that can be a bonus. I mean, I write lots of stuff for money, and I'm thrilled with every sale that I get on my literary works, but that's not really what you go into it for.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that there's become this sort of sex appeal of what I call being a writer with a capital W, which is I want to say I'm a writer. But there's just so many misconceptions about it. You know, it's even the work that it takes, people will say to me, oh, you're a writer? Well, I just second drafted my novel. And I'm like, great. Well, how about seven or eight or nine or 28
Exactly. Right?
And they look at me like I'm crazy. And I'm like, no, that is what writing is.
Yeah.
Writing is not sitting down and writing the thing. Mm-mm. Writing is revision and editing and revision and editing. And then you think you get it to a great point, and then you give it to your content editor, and they say, well, I really like this, but the last third is really just not, doesn't fit with the first two thirds. And so you take that and you just shelve it. And you know, that's what the process is. And, you know, it's always been interesting to me that you'll meet people who are what we call Sunday painters. And I say that with respect, not mm-hmm. in a diminishing way.
Mm-hmm.
And they're thrilled to put their paintings in a gallery and sell a couple for a couple $100. And
mm-hmm.
but there's become this thing about writers that that's failure, and it's not failure.
Mm-hmm.
It's actually awesome.
Yeah.
You know, it's fantastic. And like most creative projects, you do the bulk of the work by yourself, alone mm-hmm. in your studio or your office or whatever it is. And then you put it out in the world, and it's, you know, I feel nothing but gratitude with every reader, and especially right. any reader who has, you know, comments, even if it's a negative comment, I take that either with humor or good spirit or whatever,
right.
you know, they're allowed to not like my work.
Yeah.
The only thing I don't like is when they get personal, like, you know, Laurel Seville needs therapy or something like that.
Says the person who hasn't yet written their memoir, right?
Well, yeah.
All right, so hold on real quick. I want to remind our audience that you're listening to Prose, Poetry, and Purpose, recorded at the Sunny and Bright studio of Voice of Vashon today in late February, if you can believe it. My name is March Twisdale, and I'm speaking with Laurel Seville, author of multiple books, including her newly released novel, North of Here, which you can peruse at the Vashon Bookshop, which is brilliant. I'm so excited. They've set up a nice little permanent PP&P location there. And now back to our interview, where this was brilliant. Thank you so much for enlightening us on some of the backstory of publishing.
The fast-moving industry these days. It used to be very much just a very static thing. So
right.
it's hard to keep up.
Well, and there's also those areas out there where, like, one of the strategies that people will use is where you offer up works simply for free. There's a bunch of new publishing platforms where it's just free, almost like a, what's that thing they would talk about on the computer, like
freeware.
Yeah, and the idea is you start putting stuff out there for free, people look at it, they start to respond to it, and it's all about reaching out to more people, and eventually, you know, so there's so many.
That's the basis of Kindle First, is give it away, and then yeah. people get excited about it and tell people, and then people go and buy it.
Yeah, I always love the story of Memoirs of a Geisha,
mm-hmm.
which is technically not actually a memoir.
Mm-hmm.
It's a fictional novel, but it's written as a memoir, but not like in a false way.
Right.
Yeah. And I believe it was published and out there on the shelves for almost 2 years before something happened and enough of a groundswell of people started to love it that they all told their friends all went out and bought it, and it went kaplooey, and then, of course, got turned into a movie and whatnot.
Right. You never know.
So the next section of this interview will be for our readers out there and book club members looking for their next novel. Let's talk first really quickly about your other work, your nonfiction work.
Okay.
Just give us a sense of what it's about. I mean, there's design. So I'm sure there's some people out there who are going to think, oh my gosh, I really want to check out that book. So tell us about those, and then we'll dive into these works.
Sure. So as I mentioned, I do a lot of corporate communications, and I've worked with all kinds of high-end brand and graphic design firms. And then I was writing for a couple of graphic design magazines, and an editor at a publishing house called Rockport that focuses only on graphic design contacted me. And my first book was about furniture design, and it was basically profiling 50 pieces of super modern furniture design from napkin sketch all the way to finished product, and profiling the creative process. And then I've written a book on freelance design, habits of freelance designers. I've written a book on publication design. I wrote a book on stonework design. Did a lot through them.
So are these technical, or are they more focused on sort of the process or the lifestyle of people who do this type of work? I don't quite yet have a sense of what they're geared towards.
Technical, not necessarily. You know, they're basically creative processes. I would say that they are looking at good creative habits and good creative processes and examples of what other creative people do in these particular kinds of segments.
Got it.
And did a lot of writing for some magazines that way while I was getting my MFA and while I was working on some other pieces. And then in my MFA program, I got started on my memoir.
Right. Unraveling Anne.
Unraveling Anne.
Brilliant title.
Thank you.
If I can say so.
My brother gave me some help with that one.
Now, of course, your name's Laurel.
Right.
So it's a memoir, but you're not Anne.
No, Unraveling Anne is really a memoir about my mother's very interesting and tragic life and death. She was basically, she grew up in Los Angeles, and in the 1950s, she was a model and a bathing beauty in Miss Redondo Beach, and she went to art school, and she hung around with a group of artists that were associated with a gallery called the Ferris Gallery, which was an incredibly seminal art gallery. It was where Andy Warhol had his first start, and she dated Marlon Brando, and she did all these kinds of things, and she was really involved in sort of the what more from the artist scene to the hippie heyday. And so she was one of these people that had it all, looks, brains, beauty, charm. You know, she walked in a room and all the eyes turned towards her. By the time that I was aware of myself, she was already going down a very slippery slope and falling into alcoholism and not working. And basically, you know, her life became very tragic, and she descended all the way to a street person and was stabbed and strangled in a burned out building when I was 20 and she was 53.
Oh.
So the memoir is not so much the story of her life. It's the story of an adult daughter going back and saying, who was this person who was my mother?
Right.
And part of what was interesting to me just in the process of doing this was that I only knew her as basically a sodden alcoholic and, you know, very mean person, very unhappy, very hostile, just all kinds of problems. But I saw evidence of this other person in pictures and photographs and clippings, and all her friends would say, oh, your mother's the most beautiful, talented woman I've ever met. And I'm saying, who are you talking about? Like, not the person I know.
Right.
So I went back and did a lot of research on her milieu, on the artists. I was also doing things like I would go to, you know, the Museum of Modern Art in New York, and I'd look on the walls and I'd see some big fancy thing there, and I'd look and I'd say, wait a minute, that guy's like, I remember stepping over him when he was passed out on the floor of my mom's house, and now he's here. So why did these people make it and she didn't? And researched.
Interesting.
Yeah, and researched her parents' lives, and that's Unraveling Anne.
But her parents?
Oh, no. Then Henry and Rachel, my first novel, is loosely based on my great-grandparents, my mother's grandparents.
Right.
And that was a book that I'd always heard an interesting story about my great-grandmother, Rachel, that she and her husband and their five kids were living in Jamaica. And one day, my grandfather and his father came home, and the house had been completely emptied, except of one bed, one table, two chairs. And she had just disappeared and taken all the other kids to New York. And this is, you know, in the 1915 or something like that.
And was he Jamaican?
No.
Was she Jamaican?
No, they're both English.
Oh. And that was the story you grew up hearing.
Yeah. And that she had done that to educate the children and you know, and what an amazing woman she had done had been that she had done this. And that the only reason she left my grandfather behind was because he was very close to my great-grandfather. Well, like a lot of family stories,
like,
you dig into it a little bit and it's not quite, that's not quite the story. And I met one of my mother's cousins when I was in my 20s, and we started sharing stories and sharing notes. And I could never get enough information to tell the story from a factual perspective, so I fictionalized it. And just working off of that, I created this novel, but the novel does contain excerpts from actual letters between my great-grandfather and my grandfather.
Oh,
so
wow.
those are interspersed throughout the novel. And the novel mm-hmm. is told through all first-person narration, but I think it's 8 different characters, first-person narration, changing up.
And these are the ones that are in italics are the actual letters.
Letters, yeah.
Right. And May 3rd, 1915.
So it's not quite a linear progression, but it's one of those things that, you know how, if you are sitting around with family members and talking about Thanksgiving 3 years ago and somebody says, remember blah, 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 and you sort of say, were we at the same event? Because, like, that's not how I remember it. And so there's a lot of that exploration in the book about misunderstandings between people who should know each other better and how different people can see the exact same event in different ways. And so that's that one. And then...
So the first one, Unraveling Anne... It is technically a memoir. I thought a memoir would have to specifically be the author writing about their own life. So it's
My life. I mean, it is me,
first person.
Right.
It's you and looking back. You know, it reminds me a little bit of Mommy Dearest. Because she had that dichotomy of here's my mom at home and how she behaves and there's what the world thinks of her.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's a fascinating one of the things that I notice a lot in my life is I think in general in human society we tend to behave different at home than we do in public. And I've always, like, at different stages as a parent, for example, felt like a lot of times parents struggle with a sense of failure or thinking they're not doing well because when you're out at other people's houses or you're in public, everyone's getting along and everything's so great and everyone's on their best behavior. And then you go home and, you know, your kid throws a temper tantrum or your husband's grumpy or you stress out and you tend to think, I'm the only one that ever loses her temper. Or I'm the only one who ever, you know, feels overwhelmed. And yet when you get close enough to listen to other people's stories, you find out that they're having the same struggles. And
yeah, I think it's kind of unfortunate that there's so much secrets and that we have a society where people are afraid to say what's really going on. In their marriages, in their friendships, in their relationships, because it's astounding once you say that kind of stuff and just put it out there how many people commiserate and they say, oh, my God, you too?
Yes.
And it can be very cathartic. But I've always been amazed at any of the essays I've written when people have said, thank you for putting this out there because I thought it was only me.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm always like, what? How could you think it was only you?
Well, because everyone performs so well.
I even wrote an essay that was appeared in the Bark magazine about one of my dogs and some of my training struggles. And I was shocked at people who were just so grateful because they felt like it was only their dog ever misbehaved.
Right.
You know, a quote, misbehaved in very strong air quotes, because it's not misbehavior. It's just, you know, the struggle.
Right.
And that, so whatever aspect of your life it is, and it really is sad because there's so much relief when you can just commiserate and it's not bitching and moaning or complaining. It's just life, you know?
Mm-hmm. The feeling that you're not alone, you're not the only one, that you're okay. And also the belief that it's going to be okay. You're going to make it, you know, because otherwise, if you're the only one dealing with it and no one else is sharing that they're dealing with it, you don't realize how many people are also making it through.
I'm actually very against this thing that's going on in our culture now about be happy, you know, about how to be happy, how to make yourself happy every day. I mean, there's nothing wrong with being unhappy.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we don't have to be happy all the time. We don't have to say that there's a silver lining in everything and what's the lesson in this and what's the universe trying to tell me.
Mm-hmm.
I think that really puts a lot of strange pressure on people,
right.
A really unnecessary pressure. I mean, melancholy was always considered a great thing for creativity and having a little bit of a pensive demeanor or being pissed off at the world when things are not going well or pissed off or angry at, you know, bad fortune. I mean, there is good fortune and bad fortune. And and it puts, like, for example, I've had cancer and I'm amazed at how many people are sort of saying things like, well, you know, do you think that you survived because you had a good attitude? And I say, well, I'm not sure how good my attitude was, what that even means. But what does that say about people who didn't survive? That their attitude wasn't good enough? I mean, you're going to tell a 10-year-old kid who died of cancer that they had a bad, that's what your implication is, they had a bad attitude?
Right.
I mean, things happen in the world, and we don't have control over many, many, many things that happen. And slapping on a happy face does not cure disease. It can help, and it sure makes it better to go through it.
It might help if you're the person it will help.
Right.
But you may not be the person that that is the thing to do. So the idea of a broad stroke that everyone, you know, this worked for me, therefore, if everyone does what I did, it'll right. all be better for them. Well, no, that worked for you.
Right. Even the you know, people are like, well, what you have to do is drink asparagus smoothies. Well, and then they take credit for it where there's no way to know if that really did cure their
right.
cancer. I mean, you don't know.
Right.
We don't know so many things. I mean.
Well, and what I find really fascinating is the people that I know who are most I think it's great you brought this up. The people I have interacted with in the last few years who are most inclined towards the idea of find happiness and seek that out a lot, very often they are heavily involved in that area of bringing joy and happiness to other people. And that's wonderful. That's great. But when it comes to functionally dealing with issues that are problematic in society or being an activist in a way, a lot of times they don't go that direction. It's almost as if it becomes, I will not engage in trying to solve the problem because that might make me angry, sad, or frustrated. So I will just ignore the problem
because
and go
those
over
are
here.
Negative feelings and I can't have negative feelings.
And ultimately, most of the time, if you're that person saying that, you actually are a person of privilege and
oh,
you can afford to ignore those problems.
It's interesting, even just to go back to the book a little bit, you know, I'll read reviews. I read a review today and somebody
Which
said...
Which one? Henry and Rachel?
North of Here.
Oh, yeah.
And somebody said, no, I would have liked this book if the first two characters had... If she'd just written a nice... Had the first two characters fall in love and stay in love and have a happy life together. But, you know, it didn't go that way, so I hate the book.
No. I didn't get my Disney ending.
Exactly.
Right,
and that, you know, that's
right,
fine. It's
right,
fine. But
yeah,
it's just
yeah, yeah.
As if everything has to, you know, have that kind of happy ending. There's
yeah.
a great book that Barbara Ehrenreich wrote called Bright Sided. And she talks about the history where this idea came from, that we all have to be happy all the time. And it's a wonderful antidote to the, you know, pillows and, you know, maxims that people put on their walls about just, you know, you can make yourself happy. And because, of course, the assumption is that you should be making yourself happy every minute of the day. And there's plenty of things to be unhappy about. And that's nothing wrong with that.
Yeah. It is interesting. One of my authors who will actually be coming on to the show after this interview, so about a month from now, she is a doctor, and it's a fabulous look for this interview. You're really going to like it. It's talking about the role of emotions in the lives of doctors and the impact that it can have upon reducing their ability to sometimes be at their highest and best or to be effective if they're in denial of the intense harsh and painful emotions of that job and the
right.
experiences you go through if you bottle it up, if you're in denial. I mean, you know, and we talk, so you can listen to the interview. She just brilliant. The woman could have made a living as just a writer. She's such a good writer. Her book was a cannot put me down book. Meanwhile, of course, she's off saving lives in a hospital. And that's brilliant. But I'm so glad she's also writing.
I'm very involved in dog rescue and also trying to rehabilitate dogs so they are more adoptable and trying to help newly adoptive dog guardians so that they can be more successful and
right.
things like that. And one of the things that people don't realize is how high the rate of suicide is among veterinarians for that same reason. It's just compassion.
Well, doctors have massive alcoholism rates
yeah.
and other things.
But veterinarians have one of the highest rates of suicide, and one of the leading founders of positive only approaches to training killed herself not too long ago and, you know, is bringing a lot of light to this, but it's that compassion fatigue kind of thing.
Right, right. I mean, I have a lot of empathy. Like, we have, you know, our local veterinarian's office, and there's just, it's got to be so painful when you're in a position where there are forces, from scheduling to economic forces to availability forces or whatnot, that will prevent you from sometimes doing that which brought you into the field of veterinary care in the first place, which is to try to provide aid and assistance and love and kindness and health to animals, and then
right.
you get interfered with by all sorts of different factors.
It's life.
Yeah, it is life, and it's a challenge worth recognizing.
Well, it's the difference between, it's sort of going back to the book world, it's the difference between writing a book and then dealing with the publishing reality and the business side of it and the marketing and all those
right.
things. And that's part of why I say, you know, it's okay to split those things off and have a different head and not,
yeah.
you know, about how those things happen. I mean, been writing for a living for a long time.
Mm-hmm.
So the business side of it to me is not upsetting or annoying because I find it really interesting.
Mm-hmm.
But it's a different headset. It's a different set of skills. It's a mm-hmm. different world. You know, authors tend to be kind of shy and introverts. We work in isolation. And then you're supposed to do social media and do all these different things mm-hmm. now and get it out there. And that's another big misconception people have is that once you get a publisher, they're going to hold your hand and take care of everything.
Right.
And they don't. I mean, Henry and Rachel came out at the same time that my biggest mentor in my MFA program had a book coming out, and we were comparing notes. And, you know, this is a guy who, again, was a National Book Award winner, Rome Prize, Atlantic Monthly managing or contributing editor, you know, mm-hmm. big name. And
yeah.
I said, how many books have you sold? He said, I have no idea. I won't know for a year. And I said, well, and he said, guess what the marketing budget was for my book? And I said, I don't know. And he said, $0. And, you know,
boy.
So that's another thing is that you right. have to kind of keep up with the changes. Now, people who are traditional authors often don't have Twitter feeds or Facebook pages or anything that kind mm-hmm. of stuff. They just can't get into it. Or you can feel when they're doing it that it's kind of awkward and off.
Right.
But those things are really important. I mean, I get contacted from readers all the time, and some of them contact me through Twitter, some of them contact me through Facebook,
right.
some send an email,
yep.
some, you know, it's just part of the world.
Yeah, we were having I have a tendency towards that. I mean, look at me, I have a radio show, right? You know, I'm pretty comfortable putting myself out there. I'm not really an introvert. And yet I have this novel I'm working on, and I did the EDGE program with Artist Trust, the professional development program, a few years ago. And so I got a lot of advice from sage, experienced, you know, writers who were like, you know, writing is not my day job yet. And I'm published and I'd like it to be. But, you know, and the ideas of the writing life and how to come up with a broad balance. And so, ironically, my writing is a little bit slower, but I have this whole other piece of developing sort of a growing, established, and authentic relationship with a future audience is the way I look at it. And mm-hmm. and there are a lot of writers who I will intersect with who haven't even given that a thought. Mm-hmm. And they will be like, honestly, they'll say to me, you know, what you need to do is it's all about the work. And if you write a really amazing book, that is the most important thing. And it's true, you want to write something that's useful, but if you look at maybe 100 of the most successful books, and let's lump series would be into like a single thing. So, you know, you took 100 really successful books or 1,000 really successful books out there, you're going to find that each one appeals to a different sort of audience segment. None of them is so spectacularly perfect that everyone in the world is buying that book and loves that book. So obviously, even the best book you could ever write isn't going to appeal to everyone. There will be that person who wanted the Disney ending right. and they didn't get it. And I've had a hard time trying to explain why I believed the people who said you need to, as an author, be an active person in the promotion and the getting out of your book. Until recently, some people, I believe, in India did something a number of months ago. I don't know all the details, but they purposely wrote a horrible book. I mean, spelling was bad. They did all these terrible things with it. It was an experiment. So they wrote this really horrible, terrible book. And then they did certain things along the lines of how to promote a book. And they created this whole strategic, you know, plan. And apparently they sold tens of thousands of this, millions. They just sold this book like crazy, even though it's absolute crap, because they had this impeccable sort of strategy of getting it out there. Now, I'm not promoting that as a great story, but it was an example of the importance of how you reach your readers.
Well, I think that, you know, you have to write whatever the best book is that you can write. You can't mm-hmm. write a book for somebody else or follow somebody else's agenda. You have to write your book, whatever that is.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, these kinds of experiments have been done forever. Someone will take a little known Hemingway short story and send it out to 16 or 20 or 40 literary magazines, and then they'll all reject it. You know, I mean, those kinds of things have happened. They've done this kind of stuff over and over and over again.
I love that story. Because, oh, my goodness gracious.
Yeah, because, you know, there is no single standard, and you can sit there
right.
and say, you know, there's a million different ways to be successful. I mean, 50
And they won't even know. They won't even recognize it.
No, no. I mean, this has been done. They've done these experiments over and over again. You know, and you can say something like 50 Shades of Grey or Harry Potter, whatever, is bad writing. Well, maybe it is, maybe it isn't. Who's to say? I mean, it's obviously...
But maybe it was good storytelling.
Maybe it was good storytelling. I mean, yeah. There's many different ways to write something that is great or to do a nice painting. There's lots of room for lots of different styles. So you really have to focus on doing your work, whatever that is, whatever that story is and whatever, right. And do it to the top level and get as much help and feedback and change and edit and, you know, really do the work, mm-hmm. which people think... You know, as long as we've been saying it's 1% inspiration, 99% right, perspiration, right. People still don't believe that. They still want the secret handshake.
Right.
They still think you just sit down. So do you like take a long walk and get inspired and then just go sit down and write?
But there are authors too. Oh yeah, I had a dream and then I wrote the entire story in 3 months and then sent it to an agent. They loved it and poof, there's the book. I mean, there are the authors will say that. And in a way, I know there's a piece of the story they're not sharing.
Yeah, it doesn't really work that way, even if you did it that way, because then the content editor gets involved and the copy editor and the proofreader and the acquisitions editor and people get involved. And, you know, I mean, I had one story that came out that way, but I'd been thinking about it and thinking about it and thinking about it. And so, yes, mm-hmm. I think it was either Beethoven or Bach said that he wrote all his music in his head and then just copied it out.
Actual
physical act of producing it may have seemed like he just sat down and wrote the whole thing. Mm-hmm. But I mean, I do always joke, even with my corporate clients, that I have to charge you for that walk I took because I was thinking about your project the entire time.
Right. Oh yeah. So, my hard thing, I want to get, I went out and bought that thing called Dragon or whatever, and you can put it on your computer and allows you to talk to your computer and the computer turns your words into writing, because I am oral, you know, somewhat as a person. And I thought that would also help my neck. My chiropractor had recommended it, so I wouldn't be looking down at my keyboard so much, right? I ended up never actually putting it on there. It sits in the box, and I kick myself every time I walk by because it was a $300 program, and one day I will install it. But what I really want is not to be standing in a room staring at my computer and talking at it. I want eventually to get a smartphone, which I don't have. I have a basic phone still. But I want a smartphone that has that software on it, so when I'm walking, I can be talking. Because it's when I'm walking that suddenly my characters start chatting with each other in the middle of a scene, and their dialogue is so perfect and clean and awesome, and 95 steps later, I can't remember it.
Yeah.
And so I'll take a pad of paper, and suddenly I'm sitting there, you know, under a tree, scribbling something down. But I used to call my house and leave messages. You know, I'd use my cell phone to call. Okay, this is me. No one erased this. This is a note. I just thought of what so-and-so is going to do. And, you know, 2.5 minutes later, it goes beep, and you call back, and you go, let me finish that. It was hilarious.
I think there's a reason why authors are traditionally gardeners and walkers, because that's where you do so much of your writing and your thinking and getting the story out. And there's also a biological that works biologically. They also say, you know, lie down, and I'll be puzzling over something and trying to work on something. And just the physical act of getting horizontal, mm-hmm. it'll go poof. And that's why they always say, keep a pad of paper next to your bed.
There
is a biological thing that happens there to your thinking processes.
Well, that's fat. I didn't understand that. I never heard that before, but it's like, it's when I go to bed and then I'm laying there and all of a sudden my eyes fly open. I'm staring at the ceiling. Right. My brain's like, cha-bing. And I'm like, ah. So I did. Oh, interesting. Yeah. Thank you. Okay. So we are getting low on time here. So real quick, I am right now interviewing Laurel Seville, who lives on Vashon. And has a newly released book, North of Here, that will be available at the Vashon Bookshop if you want to peruse a copy, take a look at it. It's specifically a store copy. It'll be right there at the little prose, poetry, and purpose display. It has a new cover, which is really pretty. It has robin eggs on the front of it. So look for the robin eggs and the nest. And then this story, let's cover it, and then we're going to basically be done. North of Here. Okay, I would say... It does not have, as that person was wanting, a Disney ending. And I will say that I typically tend to really love Disney endings. However, this story could not, I believe, contain a Disney ending and still present what it presented to me. It demanded, I think, a more serious ending.
Well, thank you. Yeah, I don't really know where the stories are going. I'm not someone who plots in advance. I start with an idea or a scene or a concept or just a character and just dive in and see where the writing takes me. That's mm-hmm. That's the way that I write. So it's not like I set out to write something, I want to write something dark or I want to write something like this or that. It's just where it goes.
Right.
So this book is set in the Adirondack Mountains of upstate New York. I lived in upstate New York and in Vermont for about 20 years. And the Adirondack Mountains are a really interesting part of the world that most people don't know about. It's a huge park, 6 million acres, 7 million acres. It's the largest in the United States. It's unusual in that it also has small towns. So it's a mixed-use park. So there's public, it's public,
that's
private.
Brilliant.
It's public and private and huge, crazy, dark, thick wilderness.
Right.
And there's a lot of competing interests up there of how do you manage the land so that there's jobs for people who live there, but there's plenty of recreation, but there's plenty of wild spaces.
That sounds like Oregon.
It's
in a way, with all their forest issues, and they want to preserve all the natural resources because they want to also have work.
Right.
And there's, that tension between those two things.
Very interesting place and very interesting kinds of people. There's the locals who've been there for generations who are real kind of backwoods, live off the land kind of people. And then there's people that come up from New Jersey and Connecticut that have wealth. And that's been happening for hundreds of years with the great camps and all that sort of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And they have their summer camps, which are houses that are, 3,000, 4,000, 5,000 square feet. So there's, just so many different kinds of different and disparate views of what nature is and what being in the wild is and how to use these resources. And so this book follows four characters, very different backgrounds, very different people whose lives intersect in surprising ways and who none of whom is quite what they seem. Miranda is a young woman in her mid-20s who's comes from privilege and is kind of lost and then discovers through a series of tragedies that she actually doesn't have anywhere near the privilege that she thought she did. And everything was completely leveraged. Her father completely leveraged everything. Dix is a, quote, handyman who seems like just a North Country guy, but actually is very educated and smart, but keeps it very much on a humble down low. Darius is a preppy, spoiled boy who comes into the area and sort of positions himself as a back-to-nature guru, creating kind of a commune-y sort of environment.
He makes me think of the damaged children of the 1%, the kids who maybe do not benefit from coming from that type of background, was the sense I had. Yeah.
And then Sally is a local girl who's a social worker who gets caught up in this whole environment. And there's a bunch of tragedies and a bunch of bad decisions and a bunch of lost people. And, and there's also a lot of happiness and hope and growth at the end.
I think her social work piece actually was really a really important part of her character development. Like if that had not been there, then her insights would have been completely different. And I just really appreciated how that being a part of her makeup.
It's interesting. Some of the reviews that are starting to come in, people were wondering why she wasn't doing more as a social worker. But all the people that were living in the commune were adults. There's part of the theme of this is that there's really not a lot you can do when someone is bent on self-destruction or doesn't have whatever the skills or clues are, and it's a bunch of adults doing what they're doing. There is nothing to report. There is no case. You can't call the cops on a 18 or 20 year old person who's just living their life.
Right.
Even if you did disagree with how they're doing it.
Right.
And, that's part of what her struggle is there's very little for her to do except kind of watch. She and Dix are the ones that are kind of watching people in situations that they care about unravel and they can't do much about it, even though they're very competent people.
Right.
And that is a struggle that we all face. And most of us have had people in our lives like that just you can't help.
Yeah.
And vice versa. I've mentored a lot of young people. And like one of the young women that I've mentored came from a very classically, everything wrong kind of family. And she's pulled herself out of it. And she'll say, I couldn't have done it without you. And I say, actually, you could have and you would have because it's within you. You, if it wasn't me, you would have found someone else to help you. It's within you. This was someone you couldn't keep down. And
well,
who knows?
And that's proven true by the fact that you have so many young people who are perhaps raised in an environment that's perceived as being one of opportunity and privilege, and they'll end up completely,
And just, vice versa.
Yeah, falling apart. Exactly.
But we don't know. It's been often said that we just don't know what resilience is. Why do some people come out of Holocaust camps
Right.
Okay, relatively intact.
Yeah.
And other ones can never shake the horrors of what happened. I mean, it's just, it's hard to know.
Yeah.
We don't really know what resilience is. And those, I think of those who are resilient can often be very naive and puzzled by those who aren't, like, mm-hmm. why can't you just pick yourself up and shake yourself off and deal?
Yeah.
And some people just can't.
You know, it's interesting. I've always, I hate the taste of alcohol. I don't like it at all, right? But I love sugar. And so I think I've always, because I grew up not liking beer. Oh, sorry. I mean, one of my good friends sells beer on the island, and he'll say, here, try this. And I'm like, no, really, I hate beer. He's like, no, you'll like this. It has strawberries. And I'm like, okay, fine. I'll smell it and go, no, I can't do it. And so I've been aware since a very young age when I had my first chance to have a wine cooler or whatever with friends. And I just was like, no, thank you. I don't want it. And I've always since that age known that I can take zero responsibility or pride or any type of like, oh, look at me. No, I was lucky to be born with a palate that can't stand alcohol.
Right.
And that is why I don't have a problem with alcohol. If I had a palate that loved it, I don't know if I'd have a problem or not, because I definitely have a problem with sugar. And alcohol, yeah. Of course, converts very quickly into sugar in the system. So I think that one thing caused me to assume that any other area of my life that I don't have a problem with, I was blessed and born to not have that problem.
Right.
And the people who do, I respect right. that their problem is not their fault.
Right. It can be very hard, and it can be very tested by people that, you know, hurt you. I mean, this book, North of Here, Miranda hurts people and her father hurts people, and many mm-hmm. of the characters hurt people tremendously, not because they're waking up in the morning saying, how can I screw up somebody else's life?
Right.
Just because they're trying to find their way down the road and they're failing and other people are getting caught in their wake.
Right.
And that happens a lot. I mean, I don't think anybody tries to hurt anybody else. I think they actively try not to.
Right.
But it doesn't mean that we don't get burned terribly by people that we love and are trying to help.
Yeah.
And there's a lot of that kind of thing going on in the book.
Yeah. So I hate to say it, but we're out of time. So we're going to have to go. So that's North of Here by Laurel Seville. Laurel, thank you very much for getting together with me. I'm thrilled to have been able to talk to you today.
Thank you for having me. I really appreciate it.
Yay. All right. My name is March Twisdale. You've been listening to my interview with Laurel Seville, Saville. Look her up on the internet. Really easy to find her. Thank you for tuning in to Prose, Poetry, and Purpose, where my guest authors share how they hope to inspire positive change in the world or accept the fact that sometimes life sucks.
Exactly.
One reader and one listener at a time. For those of you who live on or visit Vashon Island, you can drop by the Vashon Bookshop and flip through a display copy of North of Here, which has just been released. And now I'll leave you with the inspirational and timely song, We Are the Many, created by musical activist Makana.
Ye come here, gather round the stage. The time has come for us to voice our rage against the ones who've trapped us in a cage to steal from us the value of our wage from underneath the vestiture of law. The lobbyists at Washington do gnaw at liberty, the bureaucrats guffaw. And until they are purged, we won't withdraw. We'll occupy the streets, we'll occupy the courts, we'll occupy the offices of you till you do the bidding of the many, not the few. Our nation was built upon the right of every person to improve their plight. The laws of this republic they rewrite, and now a few own everything in sight. They own it free of liability. They own that they are not like you and me. Their influence dictates legality. And until they are stopped, we are not free. We'll occupy the streets. We'll occupy the courts. We'll occupy the offices of you till you do. The bidding of the many, not the few. You enforce your monopolies with guns, while sacrificing our daughters and sons. But certain things belong to everyone. Your thievery has left the people none. So take heed of our notice to redress. We have little to lose, we must confess. Your empty words do leave us unimpressed. A growing number join us in protest. We occupy the streets, we occupy the courts, we occupy the offices of you till you do. The bidding of the many, not the few. You can't divide us into sides, and from our gaze you cannot hide. Denial serves to amplify, and our allegiance you can't buy. Our government is not for sale. The banks do not deserve a bail. We will not reward those who fail. We'll not move till we prevail. We'll occupy the streets. We'll occupy the courts. We'll occupy the offices of you till you do. The bidding of the many, not the few. We'll occupy the streets. We'll occupy the courts. We'll occupy the offices of you till you do. The bidding of the many, not the few. We are the many. You are the few.